Welcome to the Well Community Church podcast. For more information on us and our mission to help people connect to God and to each other in every neighborhood, check us out at thewellcommunity.org or on our app, The Well Friends.
It is good to be with you here this week. If you have your Bibles, we are in the book of Ruth. And we're going to cover, if we can, here this week, chapter 3. And I'll tell you what, as I think back over the years that we've been doing this, almost 20 years now, I'm mindful that our bullpen looks a little different. So year one, we had a great team of volunteers and whatnot, but we didn't have a lot of staff at that point. And so I think that year I taught 50 out of 52 weeks. And I thought to myself at the end of that, I don't ever want to do that again, because there's kind of a law of diminishing return. You know, with that kind of amount of reps, you just lack the quality. And so over the years, we've worked really hard to build our team. And the reason I mention that is the last couple of weeks I've been out and got to listen to both of Mike's messages coming back from out of town. And as I was listening to them, I was just blown away at what an incredible job he did handling this text and really bringing out this idea of God in his sovereignty and in his providence, and yet by his grace and in his love, redeeming these two ladies, Naomi and Ruth. And it was just such a beautiful picture. And I was just thankful to sit under Mike's teaching and to just kind of see the purpose that sometimes God has for us in our difficulty. And no, you may not have had a famine in your land, and you may not have moved to Moab, but chances are, if your life's anything like mine, there's been difficulties in your life, and you just wondered, God, where are you? God, what are you doing? Are you involved? Do you care? And this story is just a great reminder, a great story that, yes, he does care. Yes, he is involved. And it all revolves, this story, around this key theme of redemption, or what this book calls it, this redeemer, or specifically kinsman redeemer. And we're going to talk more about the actual kinsman redeemer next week, but this kinsman redeemer was a son, according to Deuteronomy 25, who had a responsibility, if his brother died, to take into his family his sister-in-law, and in honor of his brother, raise up a family through his sister-in-law that would be sort of in honor of him. And it was a means of the community caring for widows and those that were in need. And it was also a means by which you would keep the land in the family. And so, as you've heard in this story, at least in chapter one, we saw Naomi is in trouble. So Naomi is the key sort of female figure in this text. She and her husband are in the land. A famine hits. He decides it'd be wise to move to Texas. And so they move to Moab and go sort of across the border there. And sure enough, as they go there with their two sons, the husband dies. The two sons who have married now die. And here's Naomi, this patriarch or matriarch, I guess, of this family that's now without a husband and without her two sons. She's looking at her two Moabite daughters-in-laws and just says, this is not going to work. I've got nothing for you. I have no money. I have no land. I have no hope. I have no rest. I can provide nothing. In fact, my name, because the good hand of God, she feels, is heavy upon her, my name is now changed from Naomi to Mara, which means bitter. And she encourages these gals to go home and just says, I've got nothing for you. But as you remember from chapter 1, verse 16, Ruth, who is in some ways the other female lead in this story, says, do not urge me to leave you. This is verse 16 of chapter 1. Do not urge me even to turn back from following you, for where you go, I go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people will be my people. And most importantly, your God will be my God. And Mike made the observation, and I think he's right, that this looks to be her faith moment. The moment where she turned away from the gods of her ancestry, if you will, in Moab, and turned to the one true God and began to follow him. And they, as they come back to the land, this Naomi and Ruth, they experience what Mike called a series of just so happened. Now, I don't know if you've ever had some just so happened moments in your life. You could have one and call it an accident. You can have two and call it coincidence. But these two ladies experience a string of just so happens that kind of make you go, wait a second. Something else is going on here. Like it just so happened that in all of the fields that Ruth could have chosen to glean, she picked the field of Boaz. And it just so happened that of all of the fields Boaz owned, and we assume he owned many, he was a very wealthy man, that he chose to visit that field on that day at that time and happened to notice Ruth. And of all the servants and those gleaning in the fields, it just so happened that he took notice of Ruth. And it just so happened that of all the people in the land, Boaz happened to be not just a relative, but a, quote, close relative, which means he is in potential of being a kinsman redeemer. Now, Naomi, who has in some ways, it seems, drifted from maybe an intimate relationship with her God, through circumstances, it seems like God has gotten her attention, which, by the way, that's often what happens, by the way, is very seldom do times of prosperity and joy get our attention. But in times of suffering and difficulty, God wakes us up. And so Naomi is fully awake to the things of God. And she's putting the pieces together of these just so happened moments. And she realizes that there's no way these are coincidence or accidents. In fact, it seems that God, in fact, may be at work. And so she hatches a plan. And the plan begins in chapter 3, verse 1. It says, "Then Naomi, her mother-in-law, said to her, 'My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well for you?'" It's worth noting, by the way, this reciprocal relationship that Ruth and Naomi have. It's very special. So here's Naomi interested in the betterment, the whereabouts, the prosperity, the peace and security of Ruth. And yet you're going to find in the story, here's Ruth actually concerned about Naomi. It's a beautiful picture. But Naomi says, "My daughter, shall I not seek security for you, that it may be well with you? Now is not Boaz our kinsman, with whose maids you were? And behold, he winnows his barley at the threshing floor tonight. And so wash yourself, therefore, and anoint yourself, and put on your best clothes, and go down to the threshing floor. Do not make yourself known to the man until he has finished eating and finished drinking, and it shall be that when he lies down, that you shall notice the place where he lies, and you shall go and uncover his feet and lie down. Then he will tell you what you shall do." Now she recognizes, Naomi does, this dance between sovereignty and love, and she's seeing God at work, that God has provided a potential for rest and security. God has provided a potential home for her, and she knows that he will be working tonight at the threshing floor. And so she gives her a list of things to do. Go wash yourself, go anoint yourself, put on your best clothes, and go ahead and meet him at this threshing floor. Now, the question is asked, why would she put on her best clothes? Well, keep in mind, when Ruth has interacted with Boaz, she has, at best, been wearing her work clothes. Remember, she's gleaning in the field. She's gathering among the sheaves. At best, she's wearing her work clothes. At worst, she might still be wearing her mourning clothes. Not mourning as in it's early, mourning as in she's in grief, because remember, her husband has died. And so it could be that what Naomi is saying is, girl, it's time. We've mourned long enough, and it's time for you to take off your mourning clothing, put on your best, go wash, go anoint yourself, which means put on some perfume, and put on your best clothes and go and meet him. It's time, in a way, to move on. So she gets cleaned up. She gets done up, she gets her hair did, she gets the makeup on or whatever, and she goes to meet him. The question, though, is what is she hoping to accomplish in this strange little rendezvous? Well, she knows that he's a close relative, and he has the opportunity legally to take her brokenness and her state of destitution and in an instant raise her up to, in some ways, prosperity. She knows he has that opportunity. She knows legally he can. She just doesn't know heart-wise if he will, because he's under no obligation. You see, it was the brother of the deceased who was obligated, but both brothers of Naomi, or both sons of Naomi, had died. And so this close relative was under no obligation, but he did have the opportunity. And so in verse 5, Ruth, walking by faith, says that I will do all that you say I need to do. Now, this is a risky encounter because play this out. This is a young widowed gal who is accused in verse 11 of something incredible. Oh, that every woman listening to this would long to be accused of verse 11. She is accused by all of the leaders of the city of being, quote, a woman of excellence. Now, that's a heck of a reputation to have. Now, as a woman of excellence, that word, woman of excellence, that word excellence is the same word used in Proverbs 31, where the author says, an excellent wife who can find for her worth is far above jewels. The same word used later in that same Proverbs 31 passage where it says, many daughters have done nobly, but you have excelled them all. To be a single woman and to put yourself in a position where at night you're at the threshing floor, the accusations could begin to fly. Your intentions could be misunderstood. Your godliness could be maybe set aside, at least by way of observation, and people could accuse you of something potentially even inappropriate. Now, it wouldn't be the first time we've seen something like that in the Bible. So if you've read Genesis, in Genesis 38, there's an awful story about Judah's daughter-in-law, Tamar, who decides to dress herself like a prostitute and goes in a similar situation as Ruth is about to put herself in and pretend she's a prostitute and ends up with Judah. It's terrible, terrible story. The Song of Solomon, the woman in the Song of Solomon says, why should I be like one who veils herself by the flocks of your companions, saying, I want to spend time with you, but I'm not like one of those girls. Ruth is putting herself in a situation where she could be accused in this moment of being one of those girls. But she is on a mission to request from Boaz something that would change her life forever. And it's interesting, as she goes to meet with him in verse 4, she uncovers his feet. Do you see that? That's a strange passage. Why would you uncover his feet? It doesn't mean, as some have read into this, anything inappropriate whatsoever. In fact, all throughout the Old Testament, the idea of covering someone with your garment is the idea of a marriage betrothal. In fact, it's in the end of Malachi, I think it's chapter 2, God says, I hate divorce as well as a man who covers his garment with anger. This idea of the garment being a marriage situation. And so what she's doing by uncovering his feet is making a very clear intention on her part of, hey, I'm here. I'm interested not in being with you inappropriately. I'm interested in marrying you. Are you interested in that? And now comes verse 6. So she goes down to the threshing floor. She did according to all that her mother-in-law had commanded her to do. Verse 7, when Boaz had eaten and he had enjoyed a couple glasses of wine, his heart was merry. He went to lie down at the end of a heap of grain. She came secretly and uncovered his feet and laid down. And it happened in the middle of the night that the man was startled and he bent forward and behold, a woman was lying at his feet. Now, it's interesting that she graciously shows up at the threshing floor under the cover of night to uncover his feet and then lays down and waits. Why did she go at night? Why would she risk the accusation of impropriety? Why wouldn't she just go the next day at the lunch hour when she's having a pita bread with Boaz? Why not go and do it then? Well, it's interesting in that Deuteronomy 25 passage that we'll talk more about here next week, the brother, if he denied the right of being the redeemer to his now widowed sister-in-law, then she would, and this is quoting now from Deuteronomy 25, verse 8, she would take him before the elders of the city at the city gate, and they would inquire, are you willing to redeem this woman? And if she said no, or if he rather said no, then it says that she would take a sandal off of his foot, spit in his face in the presence of the leaders of the city, and would declare, this is done to the man who does not build up his brother's house. And in Israel, his name would be called the house of him whose sandal is removed. Long story short, if the kinsman redeemer rejected the right to do it or the opportunity to do it, he would be publicly shamed. Now that was done for the brother. It didn't necessarily mean that would be Boaz, but you could suggest this, that Ruth, out of respect, understands the reality of the situation. She is a Moabite woman. She is a widow. She has nothing. She is the now daughter-in-law of Naomi, the widow, who has nothing. She's gleaning in the fields of Boaz. Ruth, the Moabitess widow, is gleaning in the fields of Boaz, whose name is Strength, and she recognizes she has nothing to offer. Oh, he may be able to give a bride price, but she has no dowry to give. She is nothing. And so in some ways, you could suggest that she may have gone to him in respect at night, uncovered his feet as the symbol of, I'm interested if you're interested. But if you're not interested, I don't want to shame you in front of everyone. I want to have this conversation in secret. And if you say no, you maintain your honor and I leave and there's nobody knows otherwise. And so at the middle of the night, she uncovers his feet. She's lying down at his feet. And we know she's at his feet because in verse 8, by the way, when his feet get cold and he's startled, he bends forward and she's lying at his feet. So she's not snuggling with him. She's not in bed with him. She's just lying there waiting for him to wake up. Sure enough, he wakes up and asks a question in verse 9 that's pretty interesting. She goes, who are you? Didn't they know each other? I mean, hadn't they like hung out, had some lunch? Didn't they work together? Who are you? And she says, it is Ruth, your servant. And he doesn't recognize her. Well, maybe because it's dark. Maybe because he just got woken up after a nice meal, a couple glasses of wine, and some deep sleep. But it also may mean this garment that she put on could have been an outer garment, almost like a cloak. Maybe it's almost like a disguise, something like that. It could be that she's all dressed up and anointed herself with oil and curled her hair and put on a little makeup. And he's like, who's that girl? Because all he's seen is the gal who's out there with calloused hands, like the Proverbs 31 woman, making her arms strong, out gleaning in the fields. And he's never seen her dressed up like that. Either way, she answers, it is your servant, Ruth. And verse 9 comes the moment of truth. So spread your covering over your maid, for you are a close relative. She says, would you be willing to spread your covering over me? As I have uncovered your feet, would you be willing to spread your covering over me to take me to be your wife? You happen to be a close relative. I would be honored, she says, if you would redeem me. Now Boaz in verse 10 is humbled by the gesture. Look at what he says. May you be blessed of the Lord, my daughter, for you have shown your last kindness to be better than the first, by not going after young men, whether poor or rich. What does that mean? Look, Ruth is a young, we suggest in this passage, attractive gal who could very easily go find a young guy for herself. But see, I don't think Ruth is looking for her. She's looking not only to take care of her, but to take care of her mother-in-law, Naomi. And in some ways, by her offering to be united in marriage with a man who was older, and again, we don't know exactly how many years older, but older enough that they draw attention to it in the text, it's her offering a kindness to Boaz. It says, I would love to be with you because I know you can take care of me, but I also know you can take care of my mother-in-law. And that's the kindness that I think he's referring to here. And he says, you have shown me this kindness. That's that word chesed that Mike has mentioned in the previous weeks, to be loyal, faithful, or enduring in love. And Boaz, in some ways, in verse 11, says, the honor, honestly, would be mine. He says, now, my daughter, do not fear. I will do for you whatever you ask, for all my people in the city know that you are a woman of, there it is, excellence. Now, all my people in the city, some of your Bibles may have a different translation of that. All my people in the city literally means all my people in the city gate. Now, why is that important? Well, we're going to find out next week that business dealings went down in the city gates. The city gates was city hall. The city gates were the judicial benches of the land. The city gates is where all of the leaders would gather. And what's interesting about that is Boaz says, all of my people at the city gates know of your reputation, which means two things. One, Boaz is also known very well at the city gates, which might be another reason why she came at night. So if he said no, he wouldn't be shamed in front of his buddies at the city gate. The second thing it means is that this girl's reputation went before her. She's not Ruth, the lowly Moabitess to the community. No, no, they see something in her that is distinct and different. And so he says, all my people in the city gates know exactly who you are. Now, it just so happens that this Boaz is a well-respected leader who's not just a relative, but a close relative who has influence in the city gates. And it just so happens that Ruth has lived a life that is such that everyone sees that she is a woman of excellence. That word is translated in other passages, mighty, powerful, capable, strong, valiant, and valuable. Just a side note, by the way, if I can, since you're stuck with me, as a dad who's raising daughters, I hope you hear that, ladies, that this woman is a woman of excellence. She is a woman of value who is mighty and capable and strong and valiant and valuable. What a gift this characteristic is of Ruth to us even today. Now, Boaz says, though, look, there's two things happening. There's good news and there's bad news. The good news is you've asked if I'm willing, I'm in. I'm absolutely in. The bad news is there's actually another dude who's a closer relative, and so technically speaking, he's got first dibs. Now, I think it's interesting here in this regard that Boaz, probably on the DL, could have just married Ruth and it wouldn't have mattered. But Boaz is going to be obedient to the law of God, which required that this closer relative get the first opportunity to redeem Ruth. Look what happens in verse 12. It is true that I'm a close relative. However, there is a relative that's closer than I. Remain this night, and when morning comes, if he will redeem you, good, let him redeem you. But if he does not wish to redeem you, then I will redeem you as the Lord lives. Lie down until morning. Interesting, by the way, he says, look, either way, girl, you're getting redeemed today. Today is your day. Today, God will provide for you, whether it's this dude or whether it's me. Now, next week, we're going to find out Boaz stacks the deck against this dude. This dude didn't have a chance, this closer relative. And in verse 14, she lay at his feet until morning, rose before anyone could recognize another. And he said, let it not be known that the woman came to the threshing floor. That word woman could also be translated widow. Boaz is protecting in this moment her character, saying, hey, look, stay here. Today you're going to get redeemed. Go to sleep. Rest right now. I got you. Whether it's this guy or me, you're going to get redeemed today. But before the sun rises, I'm going to get you out of here because I don't want anyone accusing you of being inappropriate or immoral. And so sure enough, he ushers her out of there. And in verse 15, before she leaves, he says, give me your cloak that is on you and hold it. And so she held it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley and laid it on her. Now, the word measures is actually added into our text. The Hebrew text says that he gave her 6 barleys. And so we're kind of left to go, well, how much? 6 of what, right? The guess is it's somewhere, depending on which unit of measurement he used, it's somewhere close to 70 to 90 pounds of barley that he gives her, which was more than he did the first time. And the reason that's significant is in some ways what he just did is gave her the bride price. I commit to redeem you. In fact, I commit to redeem you enough that I'm going to give you this very costly gift. Today, we do the same thing, by the way. We just don't give out barley. We give out diamonds. So a guy wants to propose to the girl. He saves up forever, donates plasma, sells his car, does whatever he needs to do, buys a diamond, the biggest diamond he can afford, and he offers that to her as the bride price. That's exactly what Boaz does here. And we'll talk more about this redemption process here next week. But as he offers that to her, gives her 6 measures of barley, verse 16, she came into a mother-in-law. She said, how did it go, my daughter? She told her all that the man had done for her, and she said, "These six barleys he gave to me, for he said, 'Do not go to your mother-in-law empty-handed.'" So not just for Ruth, but for Naomi as well. And so what a beautiful picture of this redemption that takes place. And it ends with a promise, verse 18. Then she said, "Wait, my daughter, until you know how this matter will turn out, for the man will not rest until he settles it today." She knows that this man, Boaz, is a man of character. And he said, if today, either this guy or myself are going to redeem you, she knows he's going to do exactly what he said. And so now they wait. They wait for the redemption to come. Now, this is a beautiful passage and a beautiful picture of a relationship that flourishes in a broken environment. And when you look at it, if this is taking place, and I believe it is, in the context historically of the book of Judges, this is a very dark time in history. And so what you find is this beautiful story of redemption tucked within a history that is by its nature broken. And so it just stands out as a rose among the thorns, just a beautiful picture. And yet you see these people come together. So let me ask the question, in this culture, how did couples typically come together? Like, how is it different than what we saw today? Well, keep in mind, most of these cities in this time were relatively small villages, agrarian villages, where everybody knew everybody. You think Fresno's a small town. No, I mean smaller. I'm talking smaller still. Think like your neighborhood. Everybody knew everybody. So-and-so had a baby, and it was a girl, and you just had a baby, and it was a boy. Moms are already scheming. Oh, we can like set them up. They're about the same age. Or better yet, you had a girl and there's a boy who's like a 10-year-old and parents are setting them up. That's the way it worked. Now, when they set the kids up, it wasn't against the kid's will or wishes. The kid got to approve on it. But once it was all arranged and agreed upon, the bride price would be given. The boy goes home, starts building a house connected to his father's house. The bride's waiting until the house is built. He's checking with the father. Is it done yet? Father says, keep working. Son keeps working. Finally prepares the house for his bride. By the way, the imagery of Jesus going now to prepare a place for us. If it weren't so, he would have told you so. He goes to prepare a place for us, and surely where he is, he'll come and get us to be with him. Beautiful picture, all based on this marriage situation. Meanwhile, the bride is waiting. Finally, the house is done. He sends word to the girl's family. Hey, we're ready. We're coming at some point. And so all the girls are giggling and waiting, like the parable of the 10 virgins, waiting. And then sure enough, he comes with his wedding party, snatches her away. The party begins. They get married. It's a beautiful picture. And so you see this coming together in a healthy way. And so the story of Ruth and Boaz does not fit the model. But I want to just pause for a second and grab some insights from this text about our day. So in our day, we are living in a similarly broken world. And so the question that I want to ask and maybe answer together is, how can we in our broken world glean insights from a book like this to try to do relationships in a way that allow our relationships also to be roses, if you will, among the thorns? And so I just have a couple observations or suggestions. One, I think we need to recognize a deeper and more profound means of attraction. This couple attracts based on character, not looks. We don't even know really what Ruth looks like. We know that Boaz is a dignified man, but beyond that, we don't see any descriptions of them. And yet in our culture, we are overly focused on external beauty. We are absolutely obsessed with thirst traps and who's hot and who's attractive, and all the while fully missing the point. Why? Because charm is deceitful and beauty is in vain, but a woman who fears the Lord should be praised, that a woman's beauty shouldn't merely be the external braiding of hair, putting on of gold jewelry, and wearing of dresses, but it's the imperishable quality of a gentle and quiet spirit that's precious in the sight of God. And by the way, ladies, he might look hot with a six-pack. Now he's going to get fat as he gets older, and I promise you, looks don't last. And here's this couple that attract on something deeper. And so I think we need to recognize a deeper, more profound means of attraction. Second observation is I would suggest that we need to recognize the way that in which we do relationships trains us for the future. It trains us for how we will one day be in marriage. So I hear people all the time, they're like, okay, in my dating context, man, I'm going to go for it, do whatever I want, when I want, and then I'll settle down when I get married. That's like a guy in a big rig coming down the grapevine with no brakes, going, hey, I'm going to have a lot of fun for a little bit, and then when I want to slow down, I will. That thing is never going to slow down. And by the way, who you train yourself to be is who you will be in your marriage. I promise you, a ring will not change who you are. So whoever you are in a dating context, you bring in to a marital context. And so this couple protected their character, promoted godliness, propriety, honored God in their relationship, protected one another's reputations. Yet in our culture, we're training ourselves to divorce because we attract on the basis of external beauty. We cross all sorts of emotional boundaries, spiritual boundaries, physical boundaries. Dating looks a lot like marriage until it's not. And then you'd think we'd learn our lesson. Having experienced an emotional, spiritual, or physical divorce, you'd think we'd learn our lesson. But the proverb says, as a dog returns to its vomit, so a fool returns to its folly. And what do? We do it again and again and again and again. And most young people, by the time they're married, forgive me for going off a little bit, but, you know, why not? By the time they're married, have been divorced multiple times. Is it any wonder then when difficulty comes into marriage, and it will, because you're a sinner and he or she's a sinner, and that's life, that we punt? We give up on our marriage. Why? Because we learned to give up on this. And you know what? We'll bounce back. No thought of what the Lord wants. No thought of if there's a better way. We're just overindulgent, diving into passions, overcommitting, sharing too much, experiencing a pattern that prepares us for divorce. Third, we need to recognize that the Bible should drive our relationships, not the wisdom of this world. So this couple certainly connected in a unique fashion, but it left room for the proper expression of biblical roles, meaning it was a little unique that Ruth uncovered his feet. But do you notice she uncovered his feet, and then who steps up and leads from that moment forward? Boaz leads. And we need to recognize that in our culture, something has happened where young girls today are replacing biblical womanhood for unbiblical feminism, where they're fighting not just for equal. Equal is biblical. They're fighting for same. Same is not biblical. We are equal. We are not the same. We have different roles. It's not better or worse. It's just different. It's like any basketball team. The dude that's the tallest dude is probably your center. The guy who's got some handles is probably your point guard. You don't want to put your 5-foot guy with good handles on the post. He's going to get swatted all day. Everybody has a different role. We are equal in Christ, but we have different roles. And so what's happening is we've got these gals that are fighting not just for equal, but sameness, and they're not protecting their heart, and they're leading in the relationship, and they're initiating in the relationship, and they're organizing every date, and they're the one connecting, and they're the one reaching out. Here's the problem. Girls, if that's you, and you find a guy who likes that, he's going to marry you because he thinks you're his mom. And that's not your role. That's not what God created you to be. Not only that, but you're going to take the opportunity for him to be a leader away. So now he's going to go passive because you're organizing every day. He never has to. You know, one of the things that fascinates me in high school, you guys remember back when you used to actually be able to meet on your high school campus? I hate that for you right now, by the way. But when you have prom or formal, there's like the big ta-da ask, you know, the plane writes the invitation in the sky, or he has everybody there, and it's like fireworks, and, you know, it's like this big ta-da. You know what I found out? I was like, man, that's really gutsy. What if she said no? I found out he already found out she's going to say yes because he sent his friends to ask her first. So the friends go get the risky part underway so they know, or out of the way, so they know, okay, she's going to say yes. So then he goes for it. I'm like, whatever happened to, like, put yourself out there? Like, be a leader. Get shot down. One of the best things, young men, you could do is get shot down. Put yourself out there and lead, have her say no, say thank you then for your time, and walk away. Yeah, your buddies will make fun of you. That's called being a man. It's a beautiful thing. And what's happening, by the way, is it's creating this culture where things are flipping backwards to where ladies are leading and men are not. One final thing. I know I might be a little longer than normal here. We need to recognize the gift of God's design for parents and the wisdom of the older generation. as it relates to relationships. So this couple grows in their relationship under the close supervision of Naomi and apparently all of the leaders at the city gates, because they know exactly who Ruth is. And in our culture, young couples have the ability that we have never had before to pull away from community and cultivate this relationship on the DL, or maybe better said on the DM. So you've got couples. I remember used to having to call a home phone. You guys remember a home phone? Had a wire, so strange. Had a wire that plugged into a box that had another wire that plugged into the wall. So weird. Had a rotary dial thing. You'd have to spin the numbers around. Anyway, I'd call and I'd have to talk to the dad, ask to talk to the girl. And we knew at any point in this conversation, dad on the other line could pick up stealthily and be listening to the phone call. Well, now you got kids with devices up in their room, and they're not only on the phone and texting and FaceTiming and snapping and DMing and doing whatever else. There's no gatekeeper. There's no parental involvement. There's no parental input. There's no parental check. And if time plus communication equals intimacy, which it does, then we're assuming that a young man or a young woman, young boy or a young girl, has the maturity to handle the intimacy. And I want to suggest to you that of all of the drugs that are out there, and boy, there are many, none is as intoxicating as intimacy. And what's happening is we are literally experiencing a generation that enjoys all of the perks and very few of the responsibilities. And because of that, consequences are high. And so the cost of a broken heart, the cost of a relationship that is crossing boundaries, the cost of a difficulty of a breakup. And unfortunately, we've separated that from the wisdom of the community. Look, can I just close with this? I just want to propose this, that I appreciate our culture. We have become technologically rich and morally poor. We have become experientially rich and relationally poor, and I just think there may be a better way. And so what I glean from this book is yes, a story of God's redemption, of pulling Ruth out of the ashes and by his glory raising her up, because the redemption of Boaz is truly remarkable. But I also see the opportunity for us to recognize that in brokenness, God allows this relationship to be something special because they do it differently than everybody else around them. And I want to just suggest to you that if we are to glean some wisdom and insight, one of the little secret gems of this book might be the fact that when it comes to relationships, the old-fashioned way might actually be better. And just because the culture says do it this way, just because media says do it this way, I'm fairly confident in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and he made us male and female and created us to delight in one another and actually gave a handbook on how life could be lived according to his will. And I would suggest it's better his way. And so maybe it's worth looking at a little differently for the generation looking at relationships, wondering how to get those started. Let's pray. Father, I do thank you for a bit of insight from the book of Ruth. Thank you for the story and hope of redemption. And as we process the truth of this book, just pray that you would help us to make good decisions, to be wise, to have character like Boaz and character like Ruth, and to trust in that dance of providence and love, of sovereignty and goodness, and to know that, God, you are faithful. And if we will just live out this faith one day at a time, one moment at a time, one thought at a time, just walking out our faith with you, God, you will provide for us one just so happened experience after another, and we begin to see the pattern in your hand in our life. Help us to follow your lead, for your way is better. And we'll thank you in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thanks again for joining the Well Community Church Podcast. Be sure to check out thewellcommunity.org or our app, The Well Fresno, for more information on us, ways to connect, service times, and locations.